the type of information that they have is incredibly useful for an intelligence agency. This is a pure gold mine if you're a spy.
Follow the money.
This is the podcast of the European investigative newsroom Follow the Money. I'm your host, Emery Chatinier, and as always, I'm joined by Follow the Money reporter and my co-host, Alexander Fanta in Vienna. Good morning, Alex.
Hello, Emma. Hi.
Today's episode, we uncover how a Dutch tech company that handles confidential information, such as health data of European citizens, quietly came under American and possibly Israeli influence. The tech company, Ziver, is known for handling communication by, for example, governments and hospitals in the EU. Well, very broadly speaking, of course, there's tons of my personal data out there, but what kind of personal data is being stored? Who has access to my data? And what countries does my data generally end up in?
I mean, that's a very hard question, Emma, but what you have to consider is that most services that we use in our daily life are by American companies. Frequently, they run by American servers. So that's one. And also, we tend to use a lot of services that are running on top of other services cloud. So what you saw, there was an outage of AWS, Amazon Web Services, and suddenly services such as Signal stopped working. So that's also like a sign of how concentrated the internet has become in the hands of a few American tech companies.
And to dive deeper into it, we're joined by Follow the Money reporter Sebastian Brummersma. Together with our colleague Siem Eikleboom, Sebastian exposed that Ziver's data protection is far from what it claims to be and what that means for sensitive personal information of European citizens. Welcome, Sebastian.
Hi, thank you.
Well, and to start, let's give our listeners a clear picture. What exactly did you discover when you were investigating this company?
Well, first of all, we found that this originally Dutch company, Ziver, focuses on safeguarding sensitive information. That's their main objective. And then we found that the safeguards that they claim to have are not all what they should be. Essentially, there's ways for Ziver to read into the messages that are being sent via the platform. At least technically, that is a possibility. And then second of all, we found that this company was recently bought by a larger American company. And this company is actually run by former Israeli elite spies. So there's a lot going on around this takeover of this company.
And this story is going to take us from Tel Aviv to Washington. But before we take a closer look at those links, what kind of company is Ziver?
As I said, Ziver is originally from the Netherlands. They were based in Amsterdam. And what they do is they focus on sensitive information, mostly between governmental institutions and civilians, but also governmental institutions themselves, how they communicate amongst themselves. They also work for the majority of the Dutch courts. So if you're a lawyer and you want to correspond with the courts, that goes via Ziver now for the majority of it. The courts amongst themselves communicate with it. And they have a big footprint in medical information. So if you, for instance, need to correspond with your hospital, then this goes via Ziver. So if anything is going on with you and you need to be aware of this, so your medical records, they will be sent via Ziver. If you have a question for your doctor, you just want to correspond with them, that goes via Ziver. But obviously, that information can also include something about the conditions that you have. There's communications with insurance companies, so they also need to have a detailed outlay of what your conditions are. There's financial information there, obviously your address, your name, date of birth. So something that goes very closely towards the patient's daily life, if you will. And this happens in a number of countries. We see it in the Netherlands, of course. We see it in Belgium. We see them active in Germany. And in the UK, they have a footprint that is growing. Essentially, all the data that they treat is by its nature sensitive and confidential, and sometimes even classified.
So Ziver was bought by Kiteworks, an American tech company, in June this year. So why exactly did that takeover set off the alarm bells for you?
Well, that has to do first and foremost with the nature of the data that's in there. And secondly, it has to do with the current geopolitical landscape that we're in. Obviously, since President Trump has re-entered the White House, the bonds, the feeling of being allies between Europe and the United States have been questioned more and more. Because of what is happening to the state of democracy over there, if you will, but also that the White House and U.S. officials are very clear in what they feel about Europe, that they're not the allies that we thought we always were. And because of the fact that we are now dealing with essentially American company that handles our data, so even if that data is stored within Europe, as long as an American company has access to it, it can be obligated to provide that information to the U.S. government if it requests it.
And so right now, Zephyr is owned by the American firm Kiteworks, and that also means that all data it processes is now subject to what you describe as far-reaching U.S. laws. And what kind of laws are we talking about?
So the far-reaching laws that we referred to in the article are, well, examples are the Cloud Act and also the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And these laws are not about protecting data, but they are about gaining access to data by the U.S. government. And what is peculiar about these laws, at least from our perspective, is that they are extraterritorial, so that they also apply to American subjects, so private persons, but also legal entities, who are active outside of American soil. So if they are working on European soil, for instance, and they have access to information, then there can be an obligation for these entities to provide this information to their government if they should request it. But it also means that because they have access to this information, that they have to provide this information in case the American government would request it.
What's sort of the situation where the American government could request that information?
It could be anything, really. I mean, it's up to their disposal. I mean, there are certain checks and balances for Secret Services to access that information, but those checks and balances have also deteriorated a bit in the last, in the last years, I would say. And it's completely up to their disposal. I think the main thing here is that it's out of our control. We can't get to decide when they access it. It's fully up to them. And if they consider someone a possible threat, maybe now, maybe in the future, or they just want to get a general idea of a group of people or what have you, it's up to their discretion to decide if they would want to access it.
You also spoke to experts who told you that national authorities should have blocked or at least reviewed this takeover. And why wasn't it?
Well, I think the main reason, so it would have been for the Dutch government to look into it, also because it was primarily, it was originally a Dutch company. And under Dutch law, there are ways to actually assess a takeover by a foreign company. But those sort of reviews of such a takeover are only conducted when it concerns critical infrastructure. And at the point of the takeover, this was not considered to be critical infrastructure. So usually you would look at, like, is there the energy facilities that we have in this country, or just the internet going altogether, or the water supplies, those types of things. There's more, but to give you an idea. Whilst this actually deals with such sensitive information on so many levels, not only for the people whose information it actually is, the persons behind the data, if you will, but also for these institutions themselves, it can be very sensitive information. But despite that, it's not considered to be critical. And that's really where our experts said, wait, if these types of companies that are essentially at the heart of how the government communicates and by its nature sensitive information, if we are not able to at least review this, then we might as well just give everything away. One of the experts actually said, like, if you want to communicate in a safe manner with the court, you're better off using a typewriter because everything is just out there. It's just out in the open. So that was, their main question. Like, why is this not critical infrastructure?
When you say all this, it makes me wonder, okay, of course, so Zephyr is a Dutch company, but as you've already shared, it's used by different governments across the EU and also by the UK. So is it really only the Dutch national authorities that could have done something to prevent this takeover? Is there no sort of European authority that could have also had its say?
So, the European Union has a lot of sway over the takeover of companies in the field of competition. So mergers and acquisitions, companies over certain sites need to be approved by the European Commission. But that really applies only in terms of market considerations. So deeming whether that acquisition would be anti-competitive, it would, you know, kind of harm European competitors to American companies, stuff like that. But when it comes to national security, that's entirely in the domain of nation states. So the Dutch competition authority might be, you know, kind of refer that case to the European Commission. The Commission has no say in approving or disapproving on the grounds of national security.
But what you're saying, Sebastian, is that in fact this goes beyond national security, right? This is a matter of European security in the end.
So you could say there's so many countries influenced by this that this could be a problem that needs to be dealt with on a European level, but still will be referred back to the countries themselves to decide whether or not this would be an actual threat for them.
But according to Ziver, all of this doesn't even matter because that they claim that their company doesn't actually have access to the data itself either way. But your investigation found out that that's not true.
No, correct. No, they claim that because of the takeover, everything has gotten even more safe, oddly enough. But anyway, so what we saw and what we did actually is we looked at, we had a couple of Ziver accounts at our disposal and we started sending messages from Ziver accounts, but also to non-Ziver accounts. And the reason why we did both of them is because, well, you can communicate from Ziver account to Ziver account. But generally speaking, if you are a doctor in a hospital or if you are a local municipality, for instance, if you communicate with civilians, they might not have a Ziver account and then you would just use a regular email account. So we also wanted to test that theory because that's a big part of the use that's being made of the platform. What we saw that on both accounts is that actually that the messages that were being sent via the platform, they were in fact sent via a protected connection. So via TLS HTTPS, which means that people from, third party hackers, they will have a very hard time to reach that information because it will be encrypted for them standing on the outside. But what we actually discovered is that through this connection, so through this protected pipeline, Ziver receives the information, so both the messages as well as any annexes to those messages and email headers and stuff in plain text, which means they receive it in readable form. And only after they receive it, what they claim at least, is they encrypt it themselves. And then they say, we don't have the key to that part of the encryption. But that doesn't matter because at the moment that it arrives on the servers, it is in readable form. And they have confirmed that this is indeed correct that we found. That's where the flaw in their security is.
So basically you're saying this insight security breach into Ziver, that actually was already a problem before the American takeover, but this is just very much exacerbated now by the fact that it's been taken over by an American company.
Yes, you're absolutely right there. And I don't even think that their clients have gone that deep into it. I just don't think they've looked at this at all because they just followed all the marketing rhetoric of Ziver saying we are the safest option out there. No one can access your information, not even us. And this is something that they still advertise on their website to this day, even though they have confirmed to us in writing, essentially, that they can access this information, which is mind-boggling. And even on a website by the UK government, they state literally Ziver cannot access this information. And it's just simply not true. But firstly, we said you could maybe think, well, they're at least they are European, so we sort of trust them with this information. There's no outside government that they would run off to with this, for instance. But now that they're in American hands, it becomes a lot more pressing.
And Alex, as you already told us, this has become also a growing topic of concern within Europe. And like these days, we hear a lot about digital sovereignty, regulating big tech. And would you say Europe is in any way successful with that? Or would you say the Ziver case is proof that we have actually very little control about where our data ends up?
I think it's important to understand that in the discussion about regulating big tech, it never was much about sovereignty in the sense of controlling the company itself or controlling where it stores its data. Big tech was given a lot of leeway to you know, kind of do its own thing as long as it abides by certain European rules. There's a relatively new discussion in Brussels about digital sovereignty in the sense of, you know, for instance, having a European cloud as an alternative. That's a relatively new discussion that wasn't really a thing, you know, until 2, 3, 4 years ago. So what we're discussing now, for instance, you know, the Eurostack proposal saying, pushing for having European tech in every aspect of digital life, you know, kind of European social networks, European cloud providers, European messaging services, and so forth. But that's a relatively new discussion. There's almost no law to go by on this. The European Union has just about started this discussion, let alone arrived at a point where even inside the European Commission, the discussion about digital sovereignty is done via Microsoft Teams. I think that's just a key point to understand here. I think one important point to consider is that so far, legally at least, data transfers to the US have not been flagged at all as problematic, at least by the EU institutions who have a deciding voice in this matter. So despite, you know, kind of objections for years that the US is sometimes using bulk data to spy on people, especially non-Americans, the European Union has refused to change that assessment. So this is still kind of part of a big ongoing debate in the European Union that has now gained further currency under Trump.
Yeah, and well, I'm glad that, Alex, that for sure, you're absolutely right. I mean, I do think that there's definitely more awareness and maybe even a bigger sense of urgency now that, that Trump is back in the White House, for sure. But it's all, like, the measures that are in place are, in my mind at least, very much still in their infancy. And they are ways to protect data flows. But when it comes to like a takeover, there's not an awful lot that appears to be done. And that is, this has to do, to my mind, but maybe you feel differently about this whole open market mindset that we always have had in the European Union. And also the fact that it's, well, there's just bigger pockets across the pond. So if a company wants to be bought, and you see this in CIFR as well, it's just, it's gone. But we do need to bear in mind that even if there are, if we do go a bit further from a European perspective in trying to persuade these American companies to honor our rights, it is still a very tricky situation because we're already seeing that when push comes to shove, these companies will favor the American interest above European interest or interest from anywhere else in the world. I mean, Trump even asked big tech companies to sort of, well, ignore European legislation if it gets in their way. Microsoft has already said to a local authority, look, when it comes to your local government and their interest and a conflict possibly with the American law, we will always follow American law, just bluntly.
I think we should also consider the worst case scenario is like, the American government has recently started speaking about Antifa activists, about anti-fascist left-wing activists as a form of domestic terrorism. Mm-hmm. So the worst case scenario could be that they, you know, that the American government is saying we want to access medical data of people we have on our list of suspected domestic terrorists and start looking into using this data against these people. Yep. And that's, I think, a very, very scary scenario. It's, of course, speculative, but it's not entirely far-fetched.
No, I fully agree. I mean, obviously, when it comes to Secret Services, it's hard to provide actual proof. But the fact that there is a technical possibility, I think, already opens the door. And if there's a technical possibility, let's put it this way, there's a very big chance that that's being exploited because it is there. It is an option.
Aside from this American angle that we've been talking about, Kiteworks takeover of Zivr also brings us to Tel Aviv. And what role does Israel play in this whole story?
What role does Israel play? Well, I think that what we need to look at is what is this company? What is Kiteworks? And when we look at Kiteworks, we see that the top management of Kiteworks consists, well, for a big chunk of former Israeli spies. And then obviously we had to dig into that. There's multiple people within the top management that have a history in this unit, 8200, it's called. This is sort of like a seal of approval or stamp of approval because they only hire the best of the best. So if you have worked for this specific unit, that means you're pretty good at what you do. So the CEO, used to be an elite spy. The chief business officer used to be an elite spy. The chief product officer, same. So there's a very strong foothold there of former intelligence people from Israel. And two of them were actually actively involved in the whole deal with CIFR. As I said, this unit that they worked for is equally feared as well as admired, if you want to use that word. And what they do is mass surveillance for a big part, but also trying to decrypt messages, essentially. And they're absolute masterminds when it comes to that. So we wanted to sort of look into that a bit more. So what is the reputation of this unit? Because apart from being really good at what they do, they're also ruthless. They conduct mass surveillance on the Palestinian people, for instance. There was a very big report recently by international media stating that they essentially tap into 1 million phone calls every hour just by Palestinian people, that they were involved in very high profile intelligence operations. They are absolutely world-class in what they do. It also means that they have a very ruthless and infamous reputation. And these people that work for this unit are very well sought after, especially in the American tech industry.
So we have former members of an intelligence branch of the Israeli Defense Forces now working in major American tech companies. And is that a connection that we like should see as something purely from the past? Or is that a link that's still active today in some way?
Well, what we have learned from conversations with experts in the field is that, well, Israeli secret services are a different animal. So even if you leave, there will always be very strong ties with your former employee in this case, because there's essentially a revolving door between the Israeli military and their intelligence services, the politics, businesses, lobbyists, you name it. It's all sort of intertwined. So you never really fully get away from your previous employers. There will always be ties there. What is important to add to this is that obviously people are free to change jobs and do something else. I mean, for instance, in the Netherlands, if everyone who has a history with our secret services wasn't allowed to work in cybersecurity, for instance, our whole cybersecurity industry would collapse, essentially.
Yeah.
What is important to add to this is that we couldn't find any evidence that data has actually been moved from CIFR or Guideworks to American intelligence services or Israeli secret services. We can't say that as a fact, but we've also spoken to experts about this, like bearing all of this in mind, the type of data that they're dealing with, the people that are in the top management and their ties. How big is the chance that there's no data going towards Israel? One of them very bluntly said, well, that chance is 0%. And to think anything else would be very, very naive.
And ex-IDF spies being in management, is that something that you see in a lot of big tech companies, or is that sort of like specific about CIFR?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what we also found out during our research for this story is that because these guys and girls are so good at what they do, there's a lot of interest in them, in particular from American big tech companies. We found an online research that has actually looked into all these like former IDF soldiers, including former Unit 8200 employees, and they found that there's more than 900, close to 1,000 people that have this history working in big tech companies within America. So if you were to go through them and look what everyone's history is, you're going to find a lot of people with these sorts of histories within big tech companies that treat loads and loads of data from everywhere across the planet.
In your article, you also quote an expert who told you that this is in fact part of a wider Israeli strategy. But why would Israel want to have access to the data of European citizens?
Yeah, well, their main objective is to be able independently to operate in a way that they can protect not only Israel itself, but also people that are part of the Jewish community worldwide, so that any attacks that could have that could fall upon them can be prevented, or at least that they know about it, and that they have a lot of information about a lot of people generally to see if they can find any threats. Now, this is something that goes way, way back. In the 90s, for instance, what they did is they invested heavily in the telecommunications sector. and especially in handling payment details because of it. Because if you get into that position, you can even see not only who has called who, but also how long, where the location might have been. So all this metadata gave them a lot of information. And now we see that in the digital age, they have moved on to trying to get a foothold into data hubs. So these types of companies really fit into that strategy. And the same goes for Cipher, because the scale of the operation, the type of information that they have is incredibly useful for an intelligence agency. One of the experts that we spoke to even said, like, this is a pure gold mine if you're a spy. If you're looking for someone that you have lost because they've moved away out of a specific area, and all of a sudden you see their name popping up in an email in the Dutch Immigration Service, for instance, you know where they are. And then it's quite easy to sort of figure out where's their address, see if there's more information available. Do they have a medical record somewhere? Oh, yeah, they have. And they've made payments towards their medical bills. So we now know their financial details. We know their address. You know exactly where they are. And those types of hubs for a spy, that's incredibly useful.
I'm wondering, was there anything in your research suggesting concretely that, you know, kind of the takeover of Cipher and the, employment of key personnel with the Israeli intelligence background was something that was in any way planned by the Israeli authorities? It's more like something that is ambiently possible rather than something you have any concrete reason to believe, right?
No, that is correct. That is correct. What I'm trying to explain is that it fits into a strategy to obtaining information that has been going for quite a long time from Israel perspective. And this is something, again, that experts in the field tell me. But you are absolutely right that we don't have any concrete evidence stating that this is a planned strategy or anything. But it does make a lot of sense that people that have worked in this field for many years.
And I think what you've been telling us throughout this episode, what we should be worried about is not necessarily that this type of data leaks are happening. The very risk that it could happen is something that should already raise alarm bells for us, right?
I think control is the main thing. Like, it's out of our control. It's in the control of someone else and it's at their disposal. And if something were to happen to the data, there's absolutely nothing we can do about it. Do you want that information in the hands of an entity that you have, well, you have no control over, and is run by spies? Well, I wouldn't feel very comfortable myself, to be fair. The people that actually that the data actually concerns are just individuals like you and me, and they don't really get a say in this, so it seems. And that would, to me, that is quite disturbing.
And on that note, we'll wrap up today's episode. Thank you so much for joining us, Sebastian, and Alex and I will be back soon for another episode.
You've listened to the podcast of Follow the Money. Our watchdog journalism is funded by our members. Subscribe and support European investigative journalism.